Well, thank you very much. My thanks to Bill Campbell for inviting me to offer some thoughts to you this morning. There are few more insightful observers of Europe's problems than the scholar-pope Joseph Ratzinger. Master of 8 modern and ancient languages, accomplished classical pianist, Mozart devotee, member of the Académie Française, and one of the world's leading theologians, Benedict XVI has not only written extensively about European history, he's also lived through some of modern Europe's defining experiences, ranging from the Nazi dictatorship to May 1968. But perhaps Benedict's most striking contribution to contemporary discussion about Europe is his contention that Europe's problems do not lie primarily in its increasingly bureaucratized political and economic arrangements, as damaging as he says they are. Rather, Benedict insists that Europe's difficulties ultimately flow from a crisis of faith and reason. It is true, Benedict says, that the precise relationship between faith and reason was never quite beyond dispute for Christians, even after Aquinas. But what was not questioned until the late medieval period was the essential compatibility between the two realms of knowledge. Thereafter, Benedict says, the legitimate autonomy of the sciences that Catholicism has always recognized as essential for these disciplines' integrity developed into a type of separatism. While acknowledging that the Church's handling of the Galileo affair misled many people into imagining that science and faith were somehow opposed, the split was also driven, Benedict says, by some thinkers' exaggerated rationalism, especially Descartes, Spinoza, Kant, and Sir Francis Bacon. The distinction between ratio, that is the empirical realm of what can be done, and intellectus, reason that contemplates the deeper meaning of things, was lost, with only ratio remaining. Reason was thus, Benedict argues, reduced to empirical study, and questions of morality and faith relegated to the subjective realm. Now, the drama of this separation, Benedict argues, was played out in Western intellectual history. While Benedict says Hegel attempted to return faith to its correct place in philosophical reasoning, he tried to transform faith into reason, thereby dissolving faith qua faith. Marx, Benedict says, took the opposite path by insisting that the only valid form of knowledge was positivist scientific knowledge, thereby making the very idea of God irrelevant. The tragedy, to Benedict's mind, is that there was nothing necessary about this separation. The modern sciences, he says, first flourished in medieval universities built by the Church and gained much of their precision through their encounter with Catholic theology and logic. Catholicism, Benedict notes, always understood itself as the religion of the Logos, whose Jewish theological and Greek philosophical antecedents undermined the highly superstitious pagan religions that obstructed European search for truth. Part of the problem, Benedict claims, was that by the 17th century, the voice of reason had become excessively tame within the Church. The Enlightenment, Benedict says, has the merit of forcing Catholicism to refocus attention upon the value attached to reason by Scripture, the Church Fathers, and medieval theologians, thereby restoring reason to its proper place in Christian discourse. Yet, according to Benedict, the radical separation of faith and reason associated with certain streams of modernity has considerably damaged both faith and reason. Deprived of reason, Benedict says, faith has in many instances been reduced to feelings and experience, thereby weakening faith's claims as universal rational propositions. This has caused faith, in some instances, to degenerate into superstition. Without reason, Benedict holds, believers become susceptible to fanaticism, precisely because God becomes for them an idol when they are in fact worshipping nothing more than their own will. But splintering faith and reason has also, Benedict says, created pathologies of reason. Benedict notes that reason's turning away from the ultimate questions has rendered it insignificant and boring, precisely because reason has resigned its competence where the keys to life are concerned: good and evil, death and immortality. It also results in absurdities, such as scientists arguing that man does not possess any liberty, while ignoring the fact that scientific research cannot even occur in the first place without people freely choosing to pursue it. Reason loses its orientation, Benedict stresses, when the guiding principle is that man's capability determines what he does. That is, the non sequitur, that if you know how to do something, then you ought to be permitted to do it. Now, many of these thoughts were crystallized in Benedict's famous 2006 Regensburg lecture. Unfortunately, the controversies generated by the, shall we say, somewhat puzzling reactions to this speech distracted attention from Regensburg's real import. Certainly, Islam's theological dilemmas were a focus of the speech. But the Regensburg lecture, which will surely be remembered as important a speech as Solzhenitsyn's 1978 Harvard speech, also concerned Europe's crisis of faith and reason. At Regensburg, Benedict maintained that Christianity's inner rapprochement between biblical faith and Greek philosophical inquiry was an event of decisive importance, but not only in the history of religion. This convergence, he says, with the subsequent addition of the Roman heritage, created Europe and remains the foundation of what can rightly be called Europe. The implication is that any sundering of the link between faith and reason in Europe would mean that Europe itself would begin to lose its distinctive identity. In other words, Europe without a Christianity that coherently integrates faith and reason is no longer a European Europe. Interestingly, Benedict also noted at Regensburg that this break did not begin with the Enlightenment. He maintains that the split first appears with the voluntaristic ideas associated with the medieval theologian Duns Scotus. The claim that God could act unreasonably, Benedict says, corroded the synthesis of faith and reason achieved by Augustine and Aquinas. Another pre-Enlightenment Christian European event contributing to this development, Benedict argues, was the tendency of some Reformation thinkers to view metaphysics as contrary to the principle of sola scriptura, thus necessitating Christian faith's liberation from an allegedly alien Greek philosophical straitjacket. The third Christian contribution to the breaking of Europe's synthesis of faith and reason, Benedict adds, was the liberal theology that flourished in the 19th and 20th centuries. This liberal theology, he says, sought to liberate faith by subordinating it to the claims of the positive sciences. As a result, Benedict says, much of European Christianity was stripped of its metaphysical and rational content and reduced to mere humanitarianism. Benedict's attention to the faith-reason question is closely associated with another issue that, to his mind, has contributed to Europe's problems: the separation of truth and freedom. Benedict argues that modern Europe's attitude to non-scientific truth is summarized by Pontius Pilate's question. what is truth? This situation, Benedict says, owes something to Enlightenment culture, which he says is substantially defined by the right to liberty and its starting point, which regards liberty as a fundamental value and the criterion of everything else. This does have some positive consequences, Benedict says, such as furthering Christianity's radical limitation of state power. But, he says, it also creates tensions, such as between a woman's right to freedom and the unborn child's right to life. These conflicts, Benedict says, emerge because continental Enlightenment Europe's conception of liberty is either badly defined or not defined at all. This issue of definition arises to Benedict's mind because some Enlightenment thinkers detached liberty from man's innate capacity to know truth, especially those moral and metaphysical truths that transcend, but without contradicting, scientific data. Benedict agrees that this development owes something to concerns that truth claims have been used by many, including some Christians, to unjustly coerce people. To some modern European minds, relativism is therefore the real guarantor of freedom. Now, reflecting upon these developments, Benedict remarks that the idea of natural law, which is how the pre-modern world philosophically reconciled freedom and truth, presupposes a concept of nature in which human nature and reason interlock. Human nature itself is rational. The problem, Benedict says, is that having denied that human nature is rational and reduced reason to the positive sciences, for some moderns, the question of what is rational automatically narrows to issues of technological effectiveness. Man himself becomes a product to be shaped rationally and thus subject to the control of others. The effects, Benedict says, are positively anti-human. This exhibits itself in contemporary European ways of thinking about moral questions. Abolishing the notion that moral absolutes are inscribed into man's very reason leaves utilitarianism as the dominant ethical system, and people trying to determine what they should do by engaging in literally impossible calculations of all the possible good and evil effects of their actions. This necessitates arbitrary and therefore unreasonable decisions about what to do. Prioritizing usefulness over truth, Benedict says, inevitably results in some people becoming the slaves of those who decide what is useful and what is not. Then Benedict says there is the damage done to a coherent idea of conscience. Recalling Christianity's teaching that informed Christian conscience gives us freedom precisely because it is the primordial voice of God's truth written into man's reason, Benedict believes European modernity's sundering of truth and freedom has left many people convinced that conscience amounts to an independent capacity to decide what is good and evil, quite separate from the moral truth revealed through faith and reason. Benedict says this encourages people to believe there can be no such thing as a mistaken conscience, precisely because man's free choices are no longer subject to the demands of truth. Conscience is no longer understood as a window that makes it possible for us to see the truth that is common to all of us. Instead, conscience becomes a cloak thrown around human subjectivity, allowing man to elude the clutches of reality. Errors arising from freedom's detachment from truth are not, according to Benedict, confined to philosophy. It also undermines the coherence of some of the fruits modern Europe claims as its own. Benedict observes that in those democracies where metaphysical truths are rejected as threats to liberty, majority decision quickly occupies the position of truth in politics. To illustrate the effects, Benedict refers to Hans Kelsen's reflections upon the trial of Jesus. Kelsen, Benedict notes, presents Pontius Pilate as the perfect Democrat, small d. As soon as Pilate asks Christ, "What is truth?" he does not wait for Christ's response, but instead turns to the crowd for a decision. This, Kelsen says, is what should occur in a procedurally correct democracy based upon skepticism of truth claims. Benedict, however, observes that Kelsen seems unconcerned that an innocent man is thereby condemned to death. But such is the logic of democratic freedom detached from truth. Now, despite these problems, Benedict displays no nostalgia for a restored Christendom and no nostalgia for a pre-modern world. Instead, he desires a reconfiguring of European modernity. This is possible, Benedict says, if Europe returns to the origins of the modern movement for freedom. The Enlightenment, Benedict says, was characterized by a desire for emancipation in Kant's sense of subjecting any claims to authority to critical scrutiny. Hence, the only remaining authority was reason. This trend, however, Benedict argues, split into two streams. One, associated with Rousseau, implicitly aims at complete freedom from any rule and any truth. It's directed by an anti-metaphysical conception of human nature, epitomized in Benedict's view by Sartre's claim that unlike animals, man has no nature. This was taken to extremes, he says, by the French Revolution and Nietzschean, Nazi, and Marxist nihilism. From Benedict's standpoint, this positing of freedom from truth leaves room for neither reason nor Christian faith. There is, however, another Enlightenment stream, which Benedict labels the Anglo-Saxon trend. This, Benedict holds, tends to ground liberty upon the reason inscribed in man's nature. Human rights, according to this Anglo-Saxon vision, proceed from human nature and thus come from within man. They are not granted to him by the state. Human nature in this Anglo-Saxon tradition is more than just biology. It is also a metaphysical idea. Inherent in being itself, there is a moral and legal claim. Such thoughts, Benedict concludes, parallel the Christian conception of human nature. Benedict believes this particular modern understanding of liberty, perhaps associated with certain Scottish Enlightenment thinkers, has sufficient commonality with Christianity's vision of human nature, liberty, and rights that it offers some possibility of a meeting of minds. Both share a basic confidence in reason's ability to make the truth known. There is, however, something Benedict believes Christianity as a religion can contribute to this stream of European modernity. Not even Kant, Benedict writes, could create the necessary certainty required by societies valuing liberty on the basis of pure reason. Indeed, Kant insisted that God, freedom, and immortality were necessary postulates for human reason, without which moral incoherence would prevail. Benedict affirms that freedom requires content. Democracy must have a non-relativistic centre if it is not to degenerate into tyranny. And here Benedict highlights Tocqueville's insight that Christianity supplied the common ethical convictions needed by the young American democracy. Elsewhere, Benedict cites to the same end Tocqueville's famous axiom, "Despotism may govern without faith, but liberty cannot." Benedict also argues that modernity's achievements, including the safeguarding of human rights, should be protected, but without allowing reason to collapse into the abyss of a reason without transcendence that destroys its own freedom from within. Now here, Benedict believes Europe can learn something from America's experiment in ordered liberty. Benedict is far from uncritical of American culture. Nonetheless, he observes that until recently, America avoided many of the fractious disputes characterizing relations between Christians and non-believers in continental Europe. Apart from attributing this to the American founders' decision to have no established church, Benedict invokes Tocqueville's observation that the system of rules on which this democracy was founded functioned because of the Christian-inspired convictions permeating every level of American society. Thus, Benedict holds, if Europe is to be Europe, carefully designed institutions are not enough. Alexis de Tocqueville, he writes, worked out in an impressive way that democracy depends far more on certain moral habits than on institutions. Without such convictions, Benedict stresses, compulsion becomes a necessity, because freedom, he says, presupposes conviction, and conviction requires education and moral awareness. Hence, Benedict concludes, when moral habits are left out of consideration, we have not an increase in freedom, but a preparation for tyranny. This observation leads Benedict to two concrete suggestions, one directed to European Christians, the other to European non-believers. Insisting that a society's fate always depends upon its creative minorities, Benedict calls upon European Christians to give credibility to the Christian values that sustain freedom in European societies. First, by defending their rational basis, but also by making God credible in this world by means of the enlightened faith they live. In short, European Christians must not only think the truth, they must live it. As one theologian writes, it's one thing to be coerced into a ghetto, quite another to walk in meekly as if one deserves to be there. As for European non-believers, Benedict suggests that if they share his diagnosis of Europe's problems, they might consider reversing the axiom of the Enlightenment and say, even the one who does not succeed in accepting the existence of God ought nevertheless to try to live his life volutis Deus dorator, as if God did indeed exist. Recalling this was the advice that Pascal, a Catholic writing at the time of Enlightenment's dawn, gave to his non-believing friends, Benedict insists this path does not impose limitations on anyone's liberty. Rather, it gives support to all our human affairs and supplies a criterion of which human life stands sorely in need. Put another way, you cannot assume a rationality and then argue there is no foundation to that rationality. Either God and rationality go, or God and rationality stay. Either Nietzsche or Aquinas. That's Europe's choice. It's America's choice as well. Thank you.